We're here in Venice at the United Methodist Church, and I'm speaking with Mel Goodman. And Mr. Goodman, could you just tell us a little bit about your own background?
Yes, I have 41 years of service with the United States government, including the United States Army, 24 years with the Central Intelligence Agency, a couple of years with the State Department, and I've been with the National War College, which is part of the Department of Defense, for the past 15 years or so. And throughout this entire period, all those years, I've had top secret security clearance. So I'm very familiar with the issues of intelligence.
And in your career, would you say that this is the first time you've essentially gone public with your concerns about what's going on at the policymaking level and the level of, decisions about war making?
Well, it's really the second time I've gone public. The first time I went public was 13 years ago when George Bush the first nominated Robert Gates to be CIA director, which I thought was outrageous in view of his role in politicizing intelligence. So in 1991, I testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee against the nomination of Robert Gates. I wrote several articles. I've given many talks and many, many interviews looking at the problem of nominating someone such as Robert Gates and looking at the decline within the CIA. So I have been a serious critic of the Central Intelligence Agency for the past 10 years or so.
And would you say that the opinions that you've expressed publicly are opinions that are held by a significant portion of people within the agency, or are you far out at the tail of the distribution?
Well, I think in going public, I'm way out at the outer edge of the Central Intelligence Agency. And certainly when I testified in 1991, that was out at the extreme edge of the Central Intelligence Agency. But there are many people at CIA who agree with my point of view, particularly the need for reform at the CIA. And there are many people now at the CIA who are opposed to the Iraqi war and think that President Bush weakened the United States and particularly the battle against terrorism by going to war against Iraq. So that view is not an extreme view.
What, if you had to summarize what you think is happening right now in the circles of power and what the key contradictions are right now, how would you describe it?
Well, I think the major issue is more than just the war. It's the fact that a few people have come into government, four or five individuals, with the agenda to overturn American national security policy that we've pursued for the last 50 years. So if you look at that policy over a 50-year period, which is essentially was the policy that ended the Cold War successfully, some feel won the Cold War. This was a bipartisan policy, Democratic and Republican administrations alike. And in a few short years, President Bush, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and National Security Advisor Condi Rice, and particularly Vice President Dick Cheney, have managed to overturn that policy and take a country that stood for multilateralism, collective security, detente, containment, working with other countries, arms control and disarmament, turn that upside down and move in a direction of unilateralism, preemptive war, massive defense spending, deployment of systems that don't work, such as the National Missile Defense, which is soon to come to the state of California. This is the real problem, which is much larger than just the Iraq War.
In his book, The Grand Chessboard, Zbigniew Brzezinski basically outlines what the key geopolitical pivots and the key geopolitical interests in the world are for the United States, and particularly as relates to control of Eurasia. And he basically argues that multilateralism and participation with Russia, Germany, and France is a crucial strategic approach. Now, with the Bush doctrine or the Bush people pursuing a policy of unilateralism, I can understand that it's more distasteful, but is it really a difference in fundamental content, or is it just a difference in strategy to achieve the same ends? And if it's the latter, why is it more objectionable?
Well, first of all, it's a total difference. This is not a distinction without a difference. This is an entire different look at the international community, of the global agenda, of the way to conduct business across a grand diplomatic plateau. What it has done is endangered American national security. It has put more Americans at risk. And it's very different from the policies pursued by President Eisenhower or President Kennedy. Even if you look at Nixon and Kissinger, his national security advisor, during the worst days of the Vietnam War, which was a great horror and a terrible time in American foreign policy, President Nixon still pursued an opening with China, a detente policy with the Soviet Union, an arms control policy, including the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty with the Soviet Union, the anti-ballistic missile treaty with the Soviet Union. At the same time, he was pursuing the Vietnam War. When you look at the Bush administration, they're pursuing the Iraqi war in the face of massive opposition from the entire international community, walking away from the very treaties that were negotiated 30 years ago, such as the ABM treaty, and really flying in the face of an international consensus, causing extreme tension in the international community and a great deal of opposition to the United States. So this is a massive difference. This is not a distinction without a difference by any means.
What about the argument that really in the current global economic system, what the U.S. really exports, what its major export is militarism and arms, and that its own economic competitiveness is in decline, and therefore a reliance on the use of military force is an essential aspect of the U.S.'s strategic future?
No, I don't agree with that at all. Economic policy and globalization in terms of economic policy is far different from the militarist policy we're following around the world. The militarism has more to do with the pride and ambition and, I guess, a warped sense of honor of the Bush administration trying to reverse the defeat in his eyes that his father suffered in 1991 by not going all the way to Baghdad. George Bush the First was defeated in his next election, and Saddam Hussein remained the head of Iraq until March of 2003. So I think it would be very dangerous to try to merge economic policy and globalization with the reliance on military and national security policy. We didn't go to war for economic reasons. We went to war in a traditional way. Most major countries go to war, and particularly the United States, issues that dealt with pride and honor and ambition.
Well, what's happening now within the circles of power as a result of this? People who watch the corporate media are seeing more and more cracks in the facade. More and more willingness to deal with the issues of the falsification of claims about weapons of mass destruction. But within the circles of power, within the Beltway, what do you think is going on right now? What are the key strains that are in play right now?
Well, if you look at the small leadership group, and again, you're only talking about four or five people within the administration who have taken the entire country down this very tense road that we are now pursuing, they are clearly circling the wagons. They are very defensive about what they've done in Iraq. They are only weakly looking for some international support because they realize they are in a terrible bind. Iraq is a real cul-de-sac for the United States. There's no easy way out. At some point, we are going to have to extract ourselves, but it's going to be hard to do that without creating a greater moral issue, which is probably civil war in Iraq, for which we will be, in part, a great deal responsible. So they are circling the wagons. They're getting more isolationist. They're politicizing the government, putting a great deal of pressure on critics of government policy. And that's why you see the interesting administration reaction to Richard Clark and the book that just appeared, where the entire administration virtually has come into play to try to weaken the image of Richard Clark, question his credibility for a position he's taken that, frankly, I think is becoming conventional wisdom. We did not have to go to war against Iraq to fight the battle against terrorism. In fact, by going into Iraq, we probably weakened the battle against terrorism. So this is why I think they believe to a certain extent, particularly in an election year, that they feel their backs are against the wall.
It's been said, you've mentioned several times, that a relatively small number of people have been able to come in and basically hijack policy. I don't know if you'd say that's fair, but the question I have is, what does it say about the system that we have and the system of control and so-called checks and balances that, if true, that it's a relatively tiny number of people in key positions, that they could subvert the entire apparatus so easily to mobilize such such vast and irreversible forces?
Well, I do think the word hijack is your word, but I think it's the right word. It's the correct word, and I guess I would agree with it. And the fact that they were able to do it so easily in such a short period of time with such limited resistance, frankly, is quite astounding to me. Now, what it says for the system is a very threatening lesson, I believe, because it shows that the institutions we have to provide checks and balance are not working. And the two major institutions that I work about, that I worry about, and maybe there are three institutions, would be the United States Congress, the United States media, and if you look at the Democratic Party, in a sense, as the opposition party right now, their total failure to offer real resistance to what President Bush is doing. Now, if you look at the Congress was rolled over by the Bush administration in terms of the move toward war against Iraq. There were good reasons for not pursuing this war, and there was not enough resistance within the Congress. And you look directly at the leadership within the Democratic Party, and you have to say that our leaders, particularly Senator Daschle in the Senate, provided a very weak job of leading any kind of opposition or resistance to what the Bush administration was doing. The other stunning part of this would be the way the United States media did such a poor job of explaining to the American people what the pros and cons of this war were. Basically, they were there as sort of a mimeograph machine or a Xerox machine for the Bush administration. And the case in point would be the speech that Secretary of State Colin Powell gave to the United Nations on the 5th of February, 2003, where the press just competed with itself to praise this speech that was totally flawed. Secretary of State Colin Powell made about 29 allegations in that speech. At least 27, if not all 29 of these allegations were wrong. I wrote an op-ed the week that he gave the speech that ran in the Baltimore Sun, but it wasn't until the David Kaye report in October 2003 came out that I think the conventional wisdom was that Colin Powell, at the very least, oversold this argument. The fact of the matter is this was a campaign of deceit that led us to war. The media missed it. There have been excellent articles recently very critical of the media, but the fact of the matter is they're not doing the job that they're supposed to do as a check and balance on very aggressive government.
Well, I guess you could say that they did a bad job of explaining the pros and cons, but you could also say that they did an excellent job of not doing that. And it leads to the question, again, is it really just was this war in the interests of a small group of people, or was it, for example, in the interests of a corporate media, of the corporate media? I don't believe that the media system is sort of unconscious about its own role. We'll treat it as an abstract entity for the purpose of this discussion, but, well, let's make it concrete. The people who are in positions of authority within that media, the people who are granted greatest access, cannot be ignorant of their own role. So given the fact that the media performed as it did, doesn't that suggest that that corporate media was actually substantively in favor of the policies being taken?
Well, I don't agree with your use of the term corporate media. There's no such thing as a corporate media. There's tremendous competition within the media. And when you look at the serious institutions, I'm not going to talk about Fox News, and I'm not talking about the crap you see on cable television. I'm talking about serious newspapers such as the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times. And let me speak to the New York Times and the Washington Post first, because they were in total disagreement with regard to the war. So how can you talk about the corporate media when you looked at the editorial page and the op-ed page of the New York Times and saw resistance to the war day after day after day, and then read the same columns in the Washington Post and got support for the war? And then when you get down to the workaday average journalist, they are for the most part on their own and trying to pursue a story. But my complaint with them is they spent very little time with the critics of the war, with those who are considered contrarian. And I think they did a lot of damage in terms of supporting the government in marginalizing critics. And as a critic of the war, I feel that I was marginalized to a certain extent. Quite often when I would speak at certain audiences, I would be introduced to someone taking a contrarian view. Well, nonsense. I don't feel my view is contrarian at all. I think my view is quite consistent with the greater interests and principles of American foreign policy. And I would like to think that in some circles it might even be considered conventional wisdom and maybe not critical enough. But you shouldn't go around marginalizing these critics, which is what the media clearly have done.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your own experience now since you've taken this public contrarian view. How has life been in the circles in which you travel, in policy circles, in the circles of people with high security clearances? What's been your experience?
Well, that's a good question. I've gotten a variety of reactions. Most have been rather supportive. Some have been like, oh my goodness, why are you taking this point of view? I think the most interesting reaction of all has been in my own institution. I mean, I do teach at the National War College, which is part of the Department of Defense, and a lot of people are shocked that I can be in that position and go out and say the things that I do. But the National War College prides itself on pursuing a policy of academic freedom. They testify to the Congress, the Education Committee of the Senate Armed Forces Committee, to uphold the principle of academic freedom. When I go out to speak, I speak for myself. I'm not speaking institutionally. And therefore, I've not run into any genuine resistance. There are a couple troglodytes within the institution that have made the remarks that they want to make, and frankly, it goes in one ear and out the other. I dismiss them, frankly, as troglodytes.
What about what's happening and what's going to happen in Iraq? I've seen bumper stickers that say that Iraq is Arabic for Vietnam. What do you see coming, particularly within the military, within the various intelligence agencies, as we get deeper and deeper into a situation with no good options out? What is that doing inside those institutions to people's consciousness?
Well, I'm not sure what it's doing to people. I can reflect on the differences I see. Iraq is not going to be like Vietnam in one respect. 55,000 Americans died in Vietnam. Over 550 Americans have died in Iraq. So the numbers in terms of that kind of personal loss and loss of treasure and blood is going to be far different. But on another level, I think Iraq is far worse than Vietnam. The important thing about Vietnam is it was confined to Vietnam. It was confined to that one country. We got involved in a civil war. We didn't cause a civil war. The civil war was already being waged when Kennedy and Johnson very stupidly decided to get involved in another country's civil war. But the interesting thing is that during that war, we still improved relations with China. We continued our good relationship with Japan and with South Korea. Now, Iraq is just the opposite. We have created a mess in Iraq. There's a very good chance that if we begin to pull out, Iraq will go into civil war. And there's even a slight chance that if we stay in Iraq with the present numbers we have, about 120,000 to 130,000 people, we will still find ourselves in a civil war situation. This, in turn, will weaken our position throughout the Islamic community, which is exactly why Osama bin Laden wanted us to go into Islamic country. We are doing his bidding. Bin Laden must have been shocked first, 9/11, the incredible success of three of the four hijacked planes. Now he turns around and he sees U.S. forces are out of Saudi Arabia, which was a major objective of bin Laden's policy. And now he looks around and he sees 130,000 American troops in Iraq and a weaker U.S. position in all of the Islamic countries. So for the United States to think that somehow it has any understanding whatsoever of the Islamic community or the Islamic world or Islamic culture, and to introduce this absurd notion, this vision of democracy in Iraq, is just totally ludicrous. Iraq is not going to become democratic, and Iraq is not going to become the a starting point for democratizing the Middle East and the Islamic community. So we are on a very disastrous path.
That was former CIA official Mel Goodman speaking in Venice, California on March 24, 2004. Mel Goodman has taught national security issues at the National War College, Johns Hopkins, and the American University. He is an analyst at the Center for International Policy. He can be reached at goodmanm@ndu.edu. That's goodmanm@ndu.edu. This is Dave Adelson for the LA Sound Posse. Thanks very much for listening. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse, a collective of media activists working to build a decentralized democratic media. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based democratic media. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. That's www.lasoundposse.org. You can also find our programs available for free download on the web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. This recording is anti-copyrighted. If you found it of value, please feel free to copy it and distribute it to others, thus becoming yourself part of an active, vibrant movement in democratic media. Thanks again for listening.